This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. In Brownfields, Louisiana, there is a grocery store. Again, the neighborhood had been without one for about 15 years when Winn-Dixie moved out. Not surprisingly, the people in the community are happy to have easy access to healthy food.
I'm still hearing that. Since we opened in February the 3rd, everyone was so appreciative because they was used to stopping on this corner shopping at Winn-Dixie.
Tyrone Leggett is responsible for the new grocery store on that corner. He's also responsible for some of the affordable housing in the area, places owned by people who thought they'd always rent. In part, he attributes his success as a developer and now the owner-operator of a grocery store to some advice he got from his college football coach, Tom Osborne, when Leggett was a student at Nebraska.
After we was in Orange Bowl, we played against Miami, and before I was getting ready to go play in the East-West Shrine game, he wanted to give me some good advice. He said, you're not very big, so save your money, and you might not play that many years.
Would Coach Osborne have given that advice to a blue-chip pro prospect who'd been pointing toward the NFL since his Pop Warner days? Perhaps not. But that was okay with Leggett.
I was looking to get education, maybe work in business. I really wasn't looking to be a professional football player. I kept it simple and just felt that it was a dream to be a father and to be a husband.
I'm going to interrupt for just a moment here to say that part of the dream has worked out. Tyrone Leggett and his wife have raised two children. Please carry on.
I figure those was things that I could reach. I can reach being a good person. I can reach graduating from college and doing the things that I can control. I only dealt with the small things. And obviously, you know, small things can turn into big things if it's meant to be.
Tyrone Leggett's shot at the NFL turned into a relatively big thing. He played cornerback for the Saints, Bucks, and 49ers over 7 seasons, probably longer than Tom Osborne thought he would, and about twice as long as the average NFL career. But Leggett figured that about the money, Osborne was probably right. So after he signed his first pro contract, he allowed himself only $50,000 of the $300,000 for which he'd signed.
I've seen a lot of Mercedes. I've seen a lot of Ferraris and BMWs and Range Rovers, I tell you. But I was the guy who just needed transportation. I needed to get it from A to B, you know. I had a Jimmy 4x4, 87, 86, yeah, around 87. It was pretty awesome in college, and I thought it was pretty awesome. Most of the guys didn't think so. They laugh at me, and I always told me I need to get a new car. I'm not going to make it to practice.
When he retired from football, Tyrone Leggett got into the construction business. When he couldn't get an adequate loan, he built with the money he'd saved. But then he could say to the banks, look what I've done. Help me do some more. 18 years after retiring from the NFL, Leggett, whose business used to be entertaining fans on Sunday afternoon, has been helping out his community in a more fundamental way. And he says all this helping out has worked out well for him, too.
Because the more that you give, the more that you'll be blessed with. And the community needed housing. The community needed a grocery store. So it was things that was going to better the lives of the people in the community. Not take away from the community, but add to the community in a way that they could appreciate.
Maybe it would be silly to suggest that playing in the NFL for 7 years is the least significant work Tyrone Leggett did. I mean, the NFL is an enormously profitable corporation about which millions of fans obsess. But given Mr. Leggett's own perspective on the life he's built for himself, maybe it wouldn't be so silly. A lot can happen in 18 months of an athlete's life. She can, for example, find out that she's a superhero in disguise, then surpass all expectations, suffer a devastating defeat, and then come back even stronger. Here's Only a Game's Karen Given.
In March of 2015, University of Kentucky track and field coach Edric Floreal had a problem. His most promising hurdler, senior Kendra Harrison, kept folding under pressure at big meets. Coach Flo, as Harrison calls him, had an idea.
Right before my indoor nationals, my senior year, he told me that I was kind of like Superman. You know, off the track, Clark is a quiet person. He has glasses on. Nobody really knows who he is. But, you know, when he puts his cape on, then he just transforms into a superhero. And he was like, that's what I need to do. I need to take my glasses off and I need to get on the line and run like the way that he knows I can, and just having that confidence.
And the crazy part is, it actually worked. Harrison won her first NCAA title. Then the track season moved outdoors, and she kept winning.
Here's the number one hurdler in the college ranks, Kenny Harrison of Kentucky. Can anybody beat her?
You know, everything just started falling into place just by believing in myself.
What a future this woman has, Kenny Harrison.
In 2016, Harrison turned pro, and the wins kept coming. She won 7 races in a row. In May, she set a new American record in the 100-meter hurdles. Her time of 12.24 was the second fastest time in history and within striking distance of a world record that had stood since 1988. Next up, the Olympic trials.
So everyone assumed, oh, it's going to be a piece of cake for Kenny to go out there and make that team, but, you know, getting on the line and actually performing, it was a lot, and it wasn't a lack of confidence like it had been in the past, but it was just more of just going out there and doing it.
And how do you hope this dream unfolds for you here in Eugene?
Man, you know, if it's in God's glory, I really want to make the team. I really think that I have what it takes to make the Olympic team, and I definitely want to represent USA.
Harrison felt confident through the prelims, but in the semis, she came in second. It was the first time anyone had beaten her all season long.
It was pouring down rain, and Coach Flo was trying to say, okay, we got one more round. You know, shake it off. You're going to be fine.
But standing on the starting line, the voice inside Harrison's head didn't tell her to win the race. It told her, just finish in the top three. Just make the Olympic team. It was the first time in a long time that her goal wasn't to win.
The gun went off, and I didn't get out as fast as I usually had. I realized I was in second, and then I was just telling myself, oh, just, you know, you're in second place, just stay right here, instead of kicking it into gear and trying to win. And, you know, I settled for second, and then next thing you know, I'm in fourth, and then fifth, and then...
She's not even close. Brianna Rollins wins it with a time of 12.34. Kendra finishes sixth with a time of 12.62.
It was a hard day.
Wow.
Horrible race.
Wow. And afterwards, you had to face people like me.
Yeah, you know, you had to walk through the mix zone to get to your bags and things.
In the mix zone, athletes can't escape the media. And for athletes who've just lost when they were expected to win, it can be torture.
So, you know, of course, all of them were surrounding me and asking me questions. What happened out there? Are you okay? Are you injured?
Not banged up or anything.
No, I feel great. I mean, I'm not injured. So.
If you watch that YouTube video closely, you can see how hard Harrison's working to keep smiling. Once or twice, her face drops and she starts blinking. And then...
I have lots of words right now.
Thank you very much.
I think I just walked away.
Harrison had no hope of going to Rio, but she had 4 more meets in her professional season. So she came up with a new plan. She would break that world record. Nothing else would do. 2 weeks after her disappointment at the Olympic trials, Kendra Harrison was getting ready to go to London for a Diamond League event. She says she was still a little shaken from that loss. That's when her phone rang. It was a former coach. The two hadn't spoken since high school.
I couldn't believe it, actually. And I was just, she was like, hey, this is Coach Sally. And I was just like, hi, like, I haven't spoke to you in a very long time. And she was like, yeah, you know, but I've been watching you and I've been watching your career unfold.
Coach Sally was calling with a message.
She was telling me, you know, I felt like God was telling me to tell you to keep going and to not give up on yourself. So, you know, that's all I needed to hear. I just turned my mind all the way around and just only said positive things and spoke it into existence.
Let's turn to Kendra, and sorry to raise it straight away, but you second fastest woman in history, but those American trials.
So every time reporters in London peppered Harrison with questions about what went wrong at trials, she came back with some version of...
The rest of my season, I'm going to go after this world record and win the Diamond League.
During warm-ups, Harrison ran some of the fastest times her coach had ever seen. He didn't tell her, though. He didn't want to make her nervous. In prelims, Harrison ran a blazing fast 12.4.
So running 12.4, I felt like my old self again. I was like, well, I'm back and I'm ready for finals.
So you know that Kendra Harrison, Kenny Harrison in lane 6 feels she has a point to prove.
I just remember myself pushing out the blocks and feeling really good, and going over the first couple of hurdles, I felt myself going faster, and I kept telling myself, keep going, keep going. And, you know, I just leaned as hard as I could. And
but here comes Harrison. Look at Kenny Harrison fly toward the line. 12.58, not quite as quick. Not quite as quick as in the heats. But she won by a huge margin. And she says once again, you'll be missing me in Rio. I am number one.
Harrison had won, but according to the stadium clock, she hadn't done what she'd set out to do. She hadn't broken that world record.
I remember looking up and I saw 12.5, and I was just like, Kenny, be grateful that you came out here and you won. And you just beat three of the girls that are going to Brazil. So, you know, I just thought positive thoughts.
But the clock was displaying the time for the second-place finisher. Harrison had leaned so hard at the line that she had ducked under the timer, and she didn't even notice when her new official time flashed up on the screen.
No, I mean, I remember the crowd, like, getting really loud, but I don't know, I was just like, oh, well, they're just happy that I won. And then I remember Nia Ali, like, tapped me on the shoulder and was like, look, Kenny.
Look at the clock.
Harrison called Coach Sally back and thanked her. And then August rolled around. Did you watch the Olympics?
Yes.
And what was that like?
It was hard, but I just took it as motivation. And, you know, when I was at practice, all I kept thinking about was the Olympics are on right now, so train hard because your time will come.
The Tokyo Olympics will kick off on Friday, July 24th, 2020. And Kendra Harrison plans to be ready. For Only a Game, I'm Karen Given.
We have lots more coming up on Only a Game, but first I'd like to thank OAG John, who left this review of our podcast. I have been listening to the podcast for several years now. I've been entertained while learning a lot about all sports. I especially like stories about sports history. Well, OAG John, you've come to the right place. I just have to wonder what OAG stands for. Perhaps he works in the office of the Attorney General, or he's written for an official airline guide. Consider a review of your own on iTunes or Stitcher. It helps other listeners to find our show. I'm Bill Littlefield, and it's time for Three Stories You Should Know. This week, we're going to begin with a tale of espionage. This is silly. Seriously, my guests this time around are Michael Lee of Yahoo Sports and Rachel Bachman of The Wall Street Journal. Welcome back to both of you.
Thank you. Great to be here, Bill.
Rachel, if that really is your name, please give us the case report.
Well, Bill, you've heard of WikiLeaks. Now we have WakeyLeaks.
Uh-oh.
The radio announcer for Wake Forest University football was fired this week after school officials discovered he'd been revealing inside information to opponents since 2014. At least three teams have been contacted about their potential involvement, and one of them, Louisville, actually confirmed it received a few plays, but said that none of them were used in this year's game, so it didn't affect the outcome, which Louisville, by the way, won by 32 points. Intrigue.
It worked.
So there are a lot of questions coming up, of course, in the wake of this revelation. By the way, Wake Forest is playing in a bowl game, so their season is still active. You know, one question, how many teams received plays in advance, and how were the outcomes of those games affected? And the biggest question, which has not been answered yet, is why would the announcer, who is a Wake Forest alum, do this?
It's a question hanging in the air for Michael to answer it. Go.
Well, I have two thoughts on this. One is sometimes it's not best to keep your enemies close to you, you know, because this was a guy who wanted the head coaching job and didn't get it.
Ah.
And this was probably the best way for him to sabotage the staff that was there. And two, You're playing Wake Forest. Do you really need inside information to beat one of the sorriest teams in the ACC? I mean, I understand that, you know, yeah, you don't want to have all your secret plays revealed, but you're Wake Forest.
All right, Michael, you had some answers. Rachel, I'm going to go back to questions on this one. Did Wake Forest know their plays were being given to the opposition? Because why else would they not use any of the plays that were given to the opposition? And will this nefarious play-by-play guy be waterboarded until he confesses that Vladimir Putin was behind the entire outrage? I'm having a very hard time seeing this as a universal problem. But is it? Is college football threatened, college football as we know it?
Yes, I would say this is potentially a big problem. And the reason is because the whole reason why sports are compelling is because they're supposed to be fair, right? Mm. We're supposed to not know the outcomes in advance. I mean, this is why Pete Rose is not in the Hall of Fame, because he bet on baseball and that raised the specter of whether games were altered because of his betting and the involvement of gambling. So, yeah, this is potentially a big issue if the fairness of games is in doubt.
Michael, I understand you've been thinking about an exceptional example of mediocrity, and what an interesting combination of words that is. Anyway, please explain.
Well, this week, the Los Angeles Rams fired a coach whose career is a monument to mediocrity, and that's Jeff Fisher. But there's a really big loser in this entire thing, and it has nothing to do with Jeff Fisher. The really big loser is Dan Reeves. When the Rams fired Jeff Fisher, he was 4-9. And he tied Dan Reeves for the all-time loss record. He was fired just before he got ready to play Seattle Seahawks. So if he got a chance to finish the season, he would have been able to hold on as the losingest coach in NFL history, which is something that Jeff Fisher has really earned over his last 22 years. But being the losingest coach doesn't necessarily mean that you're sorry. It means that you have longevity. Now, Fisher's longevity makes no sense. Jeff Fisher reached one Super Bowl. Now, Dan Reeves, on the other hand, reached 4 Super Bowls, 3 with the Broncos and 1 with the Falcons. But the worst part about Fisher going down is that the record's going to stand for some time, and there won't be another coach that has a chance to get the all-time loss record. Bill Belichick right now is the closest. Bill Belichick is the closest with 115. Belichick could lose every game for the next 6 seasons and still have a better winning percentage than Jeff Fisher. And if Fisher was hired by another team and went 16-0 in his first season, he still had fewer wins than Dan Reeves. So I ask, how can someone be so mediocre for so long and still get paid?
Rachel, the case against Jeff Fisher has been made. Do you wish to speak on behalf of the defense?
Actually, no. I am totally baffled by this. I have no idea what secret power or secret information Jeff Fisher has in his possession. My only guess is that he must be the best interview in NFL history or is the best at managing up. This is truly baffling, especially in an age where it seems like GMs and owners are quicker than ever to fire coaches. He has incredible staying power.
This is the sort of story that makes me wonder how responsible a coach is for the performance of a team. Long time ago, I asked Gino Auriemma, the coach of the women's basketball team at UConn, what advice he would give a coach trying to build a good women's basketball team. And he said, recruit Rebecca Lobo. I don't know if the mediocrity of a team should be blamed on a coach any more than the great success of a team should be attributed to a coach. Maybe we've made too much of these alleged geniuses in both cases. Michael, what do you think?
I think in some cases the coach does make a difference. And in this case, he's the one that's actually in charge of picking the players. So he had a lot of responsibility that had more to do with X's and O's. And when your players Ty Gurley this year said they run a middle school offense, I think that kind of points squarely at the coach and his staff.
It's not good unless you're playing other middle schools.
Yeah, I think they beat some middle school teams. I'll give you that.
All right, this week, Yahoo Sports released the results of their survey of National Hockey League fans. 51% of the fans said that a formal ban on fighting would have, quote, no impact on their viewership. 24% said a ban would make them less likely to watch. 25% said they'd be more likely to watch. I know that survey results can be interpreted in various ways, and I'm oversimplifying the data. But as far as I'm concerned, the bottom line here is that if fights were eliminated from the National Hockey League, the league would be no less popular than it is now. Also, games would more often depend on what the fastest, most highly skilled players can do on the ice. Pro hockey, at its worst, would cease to resemble pro wrestling, and we wouldn't have to witness the goofy spectacle of two guys trying to pull shirts over each other's heads and gain balance on the ice while throwing punches. And then there are the injuries that happen sometimes during these fights. So you guys can interpret this survey any way you like. I say the results argue that the NHL should just go ahead, eliminate fighting, and then cross their fingers and hope that the survey is pretty much right. Michael, what do you think?
Well, as someone who really doesn't watch a lot of NHL, I've only been to three games in my life, and the only one that stood out is the one where they were fighting a lot. And
there goes my entire case.
I went to a Blackhawks and a Lightning game, and I was really fighting, like, this is really dull. And then once I started fighting, I got really into it. Mm. So for me, the fighting is probably the funniest part of the whole event, because for me, it's hard to keep track of the puck. I don't really know what's going on. I don't understand the rules, but I understand two guys slugging each other for a long time.
Yeah, but
so,
two guys slugging each other while they're both trying to stay balanced on ice.
That's what makes it so incredible.
No.
They're on blades. If you've gone ice skating, you know how hard it is to keep your balance on those skates. And they're like just drilling
this
each other
true.
In the
he
face
makes a good point.
And still
oh,
standing.
Rachel.
That's an impressive feat. That way you get two sports. You get hockey and boxing in the same event. You pay
no,
for well, events.
No, it's not boxing when a guy's wearing a helmet and they both have skates. It's
a lot
not
of times they rip off the helmets and go to work. You know?
Oh, gosh. Once again, I've tossed up the softball that you guys have fouled off.
You think I fouled it
no,
off?
I've
I think
got
I hit it out the park.
Rachel, take it from there.
I think the strongest argument for your case, Bill, is Olympic hockey. No fighting in Olympic hockey. And when you get past the early garbage rounds of with the countries that can't play, the games are fantastic. And so I think if you look at that, definitely no fighting does not detract from that product. Now, they only play over 4 years, and so there is a scarcity element, and you've got matchups you don't normally see. But that, I think, illustrates that if you get two really competitive teams, you don't necessarily need fighting to prop it up.
Yeah, and speaking for somebody who's been in New England for a good many years, where there are several excellent hockey teams, they don't have that much fighting in college hockey. And if they do, guys tend to get suspended. And so, yeah, we see great hockey up here and very little fighting, except when the Bruins are on the ice down the street. All right. I'm sorry that my argument didn't convince all of you, but I look forward to welcoming both of you back anyway. My guests for this week's Three Stories You Should Know have been Michael Lee of Yahoo Sports and Rachel Bachman of The Wall Street Journal. Thank you, both of you.
Thank you, Bill.
Appreciate it. Great to be on.
Don't mess with a good thing. I've heard that saying before. It's probably true. It's probably also true that you shouldn't necessarily take two good things, shove them together, and expect a great result. But we couldn't help ourselves. Only a game's Martin Kessler has the story.
Trump is kind of like the Rudy of politics.
That's comedian Dustin Chafin performing stand-up about a month before the election.
Like, it's kind of been fun watching him, you know, run for president, but we're not going to let him play a whole game. Yeah. That was very NPR. I like that one. Okay.
Chafin was part of an experiment that Only a Game concocted with the Broadway Comedy Club in New York City. It began with an idea. A night of stand-up comedy with only sports jokes. Sports and comedy, both fun on their own. Surely they'd go together like baseball and Cracker Jacks, Stockton and Malone, and the NCAA and exploitation, right? But think about it for a second. Do you know any good sports jokes? I didn't. I actually Googled sports jokes, and this was the first one that came up.
What did the football coach say to the broken vending machine?
Wait for it.
He said, give me a quarterback.
Okay, wow. So Google wasn't a help, but eventually I remembered this.
Well, let's see now. We have on our team, we have who's on first, what's on second, I don't know who's on third.
That's what I want to find out, the guy's names.
That, of course, is Abbott and Costello.
You know the guy's names on the baseball team?
Yes.
Well, go ahead. Who's on first?
Yes.
I mean the guy's name.
Who?
The guy playing first.
Who?
The guy playing first base.
Who?
The guy on first base.
Who is on first?
What are you asking me for? I don't know.
All right, pretty good. But that routine debuted in the 1930s. That was 80 years ago. With a drought like that, I started to worry. Could a night of sports stand-up actually be funny? More specifically, can NPR-appropriate sports stand-up actually be funny? Luckily, Broadway Comedy Club host Amory Castillo and about a dozen brave comedians were willing to step to the plate. Step to the plate. Get it? Okay, I promise their jokes were better than that.
All right, so yeah, I'm excited to be here. I am from New Hampshire. A little bit more about me. I just turned 30 years old this year.
That's Paul Landwehr. He was one of the first comedians to take the mic. But Paul didn't start with sports.
Kind of some big news, though. I didn't come here to just brag or anything, but I've actually been kind of killing it. I actually finally moved out of my parents' basement, everybody. So it's a pretty big deal for me. Thank you. Appreciate that. One person. Thank you. Yes, it got flooded.
Every stand-up comedy night has the guy who still lives with his parents, right? But then Paul started talking about his adult soccer league and how his dad still watches him play.
He cheers for me when I'm out there. He's just like, yeah, go, Paul, go! Even when I score, he's still cheering. He's like, no, just keep going. Move out!
Athleticism, or more accurately, a lack of athleticism, became a common theme. Here's James Mattern.
I was a bad Little League player, okay, which I'm sure shocks no one. I was a Little League baseball player where the third base coach was like, come on, a walk's as good as a hit. A walk's as good as a hit. If you play Little League and they tell you a walk's as good as a hit, you should quit and play soccer, all right?
Now, if you thought Paul and James were being hard on themselves, wait until you hear Freddie G.
I look like Blake Griffin if he was really into accounting. All right. Being a male redhead, you don't feel very sexy. Like, in New York, I'm a best of six. But in Cincinnati, I'm a solid eight. Because I look like their quarterback. Andy Dalton is the best possible version of this. Which means the best possible version of this still can't make it out of the wildcard round.
Self-deprecating humor is one pillar of stand-up comedy. Dating is another. And there was even some of that on Sports Night. Here's Veronica Garza.
They did some studies, and the people who fill out their bracket on DraftKings, it's about 85% of them are men. They're between the ages of 25 and 35. They make between $85K and $100K a year. So you're thinking to yourself, this is a good DraftKings app, but it's an even better Tinder app.
Of course, comedians are also famous for saying things that are a bit, or a lot, offensive. But that wouldn't happen on NPR Sports Night, right?
Let me tell you guys something.
That's Nate Fridson.
If you have white guilt and you're looking to settle that debt, move to the hood and start playing pickup basketball. You will be even in a week.
And here's Dustin Chafin again.
I'm part Native American. That's Choctaw. That's the thing. I can't take the sports logos, right? The Native American teams, right? Isn't that still racist? People don't realize how racist that is, right? Right, I don't know, Washington Redskins, Cleveland Indians, right? You couldn't do that any other race, right? You couldn't have, like, the Baltimore Blackies, you know what I mean? You couldn't have, like, the Long Island Jews, right? Gabble Hasidic curl in a calculator, you couldn't do that.
Okay, let's pull back a little bit. Let's go with something a bit less heavy-handed. Freddie G., please rescue us from getting too many angry tweets and emails.
I think a lot about the sports team's names. The worst sports team name is the Brooklyn Nets. They're the only team named after a piece of equipment from that sport. I mean, there's no football team called the Goalposts or baseball team called the Steroids. It's crazy. The net is the least important part of the basketball equipment. Naming a basketball team the Nets is kind of like naming a clothing store the Tags.
So can sports and comedy go together? Sure, sports jokes work for the same reason any joke works. When people poke fun at themselves, it's funny. It doesn't matter if they're talking about their ugly noses or their Little League batting slumps. Along that line, there's one last sure bet for succeeding at stand-up, sports-themed or otherwise. Break the fourth wall and let people laugh at themselves. Here's Michelle Tomko to close this out.
It's a sports show on NPR. That's crazy, right? Like, I know all of us diehard sports fans get our latest sports news from NPR, clearly. Clearly, that's the place to go. It's like going to Fox News for facts. Except maybe golf. Golf would be good for NPR, right? Diane Rehm and Terry Gross doing golf, because they have soft talkers, and they're soft talkers, right? Well, we're on the 18th hole, Diane Rehm here. Terry Gross is like, I want to go back. I just want to go back a minute. I want to play an excerpt from when you teed off. Like, I could see golf, but like other sports on NPR, that's kind of weird.
For Only a Game, I'm Martin Kessler.
For more information on Broadway Comedy Club or any of the comedians you just heard, visit onlyagame.org. We'll be right back with Charlie Pierce and more sports NPR style. Ahead on Only a Game, Zalan Wang treks across the country on a bike of destiny and karma.
It's a silver white color, and as soon as I saw that bike, I knew the exact name for it. It's the White Dragon Horse. I knew that the bike wanted a name.
And you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Only a Game NPR. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up next week on Only a Game, we meet Jack Taylor. He's the former college basketball player who scored 138 points in a single game. But now I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for our discussion of the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
It appears that the NBA and the Players Union have struck a deal for a new collective bargaining agreement, so peace will prevail. What are the key items in the new deal?
Well, first of all, the salaries are going to jump. The average salary is going to jump up to about $9 million a year, and there'll be some significant raises in things like rookie scale deals and minimum salary contracts. Basically, what this deal does is ensure labor peace, which is basically what CBAs are supposed to do.
Charlie, we had some sad news this week. Longtime NBA broadcaster Craig Sager passed away on Thursday after a two-year battle with leukemia. A lot of people going to remember him for his incredibly colorful sports coats and other attire. What do you remember him for?
Just for being one of the most decent human beings I've ever met, plus somebody who was absolutely whatever the opposite of full of yourself is, he was it. And he was almost universally beloved around the league.
NBA players change teams all the time. Coaches change teams as well. For example, Darren Erman, now an assistant with the New Orleans Pelicans, used to be employed by the Golden State Warriors, so it was okay for Erman to high-five Steph Curry after Curry dropped a three-pointer on Erman's current employer, or not?
No, fans are upset, and they probably have a minor right to be, although this kind of thing has gone on in the NBA for as long as I can remember. There's a very, very famous video of the game in which Larry Bird scored 60 points against the Atlanta Hawks, and his points 58, 59, and 60 came on a ludicrous three-point shot from right in front of the Atlanta bench. And after it goes in, you can see four guys on the end of the Atlanta bench get so taken with hilarity, they fall off the bench. This is neither unprecedented nor something to get very upset about.
Baylor is the number three women's college basketball team this season. On Thursday night, Baylor coach Kim Mulkey was intentionally trying to make her team a little less great. Why was that?
Because they were winning the game by 108 points, Bill.
She kept trying to take people out, screw up the rhythm of her own
team. She did everything
team.
But take volunteers from the stands. Hey, yo, fat guy, you want to come out here and play point guard? And you know the amazing thing about women's basketball? Baylor will still lose to Connecticut by 15.
We have talked occasionally about ways in which football coaches have motivated their players. Are you okay with the tactic head coach Ben McAdoo used to fire up the New York Giants before last Sunday's game?
I don't know how fired up they were, but it was a great piece of video. There's now a viral video of a man in Australia rescuing his dog from a headlock being applied by a kangaroo by squaring off against the kangaroo, hitting the kangaroo squarely in the chops. Hmm. The guy throws a hell of a punch, I have to admit. And the great thing about the video is that the kangaroo never moves.
Yeah.
It just kind of stands there and looks at him funny.
Speaking of the Giants, they played Pittsburgh on December the 4th and afterward complained that the Steelers were using, wait for it, underinflated football. So I am assuming that Roger Goodell's Intrepid Deflation Investigation Squad was sent in right away. Sanctions were levied. The commissioner evilly cackling in his office. Business as usual, right?
He talked about it on The View. No, absolutely not. He says the officials followed the protocol, so nothing to see here. Let's move on. Roger Goodell continues to be a fool.
Richard Sherman of the Seattle Seahawks does not like to play football on Thursday night, and he said so this week. He says that by Thursday night, he'd be only about 50 to 60% recovered from Sunday's football game. This is a health issue first, but it's also a quality of entertainment issue, at least as he's presenting it. What do you think about Thursday night games?
I could not agree with him more. The Thursday night games are always lemons. They are dangerous to the players. The quality of play is awful. Richard Sherman is a smart guy. Richard Sherman should be the commissioner of the NFL one day, because very often he's the only person in the league who makes sense.
One of Arnold Palmer's Masters trophies went at auction this week for a cool $444,000. This wouldn't be that big a deal as auction items go, but I understand Arnie had to pay for the trophy in the first place.
The Augusta National Country Club will not change its rules for anybody. He had to buy his own trophy. He won the thing four times, so that's a lot of money and hardware. I have to say the trophy is darling, though. It has a replica of the Augusta Clubhouse with verandas and everything on there. I think almost 450 grand is probably the price for it.
The fashion world heaved a great sigh of relief this week upon learning that Major League Baseball players will no longer be wearing dresses under duress. That's a sentence I never anticipated writing, but anyway...
They're banning the hazing of rookies, which is a good thing. And they're banning the hazing, that specifically the requirement that rookies wear women's clothing, because it's insulting to women, insulting to couturier, and basically insulting to human beings. So I'm glad this is happening.
And finally, Charlie, there's a theme park in Japan called Space World, and it has to do with space. And they have a skating rink, and it's not in space. But anyway, they came under fire a couple of weeks ago after it was learned that something about their rink was a little fishy. What was that?
They froze 5,000 various kinds of sea creatures to the floor of the ice rink.
Oh.
And the public found this grotesque and embarrassing. And if you saw the photos, you'll understand why. I'll tell you, I think that the only person you can get on here to truly discuss this would be Mrs. Paul.
You can find the sports writing of Charlie Pierce in Sports Illustrated from time to time. And he joins me each week on Only a Game as well. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
Strictly speaking, the cosmic tale of the White Dragon Horse begins without the White Dragon Horse.
I encountered this particular cosmic tale when I opened up the 2016 edition of Best American Sports Writing. The story is about Zilong Wang. It was written for Bicycling Magazine by John Brandt.
Zilong grew up in Shanghai. His first bike was a clunker, like most kids rode around in. But when he was in 13 in middle school, he had the opportunity to buy this beautiful, shining hybrid giant bike.
A classmate of mine said he can sell me one at about half or one-third of the price. And I know for sure that he's selling me a stolen bike. But I wanted the bike so much, and I want to let him shoulder all the bad karma. So I wrote up a contract on a piece of paper, say if there is anything wrong, any people come after me for the bike, he is responsible. I'm not responsible.
I didn't know that karma was responsive to contracts. I thought it was like something more mysterious than that.
That's right. Yeah, later I learned the hard way. After about a few months of riding that bike I knew was a stolen bike, it got stolen by somebody else again. So I guess that's how karma actually works.
Zilong looked for the bike, of course. He never found it.
Easy come, easy go. It's karma, so there's no way I can get the bike back.
The years rolled by, and Zilong, like lots of young men in China, decided that he would try to further his education by coming to the U.S. He chose Hampshire College in Amherst, Massachusetts, a non-traditional college without grades. A couple of Hampshire alumni had decided to learn about the U.S. by riding across the country by bicycle. They'd survived the adventure. Zilong liked the idea, and after graduation, he found a bike he wanted to ride. It was a surly long-haul trucker. It wasn't fancy, but it was right.
And it's a silver-white color, and as soon as I saw that bike, I knew the exact name for it. It's the White Dragon Horse.
I've been riding the same bicycle now for 5 years, and I have yet to name it, but what made you feel it had to have a name?
I didn't want to give it a name, but the journey called for a name. The White Dragon Horse is a mystical creature from the story Journey to the West, Xi Yu Ji. It described the Chinese monk who walked all the way from China to India to bring back the Buddha's teaching. And the horse that the monk rode was the white dragon horse. As soon as I saw the bike, I knew that the bike wanted a name.
Part of what attracted John Brandt to the story was the audacity of the journey. Another part of the attraction was Zelong's daily plan.
He decided every night he was going to knock on the door of a stranger, knock on the door and ask if he could pitch his tent in the backyard.
I had no confidence that it would work at all. So the first night I could not work up the courage, so I stayed in the empty Boy Scout camp. But there were so many mosquitoes, I got 30 bites, and when I tried to use a hose there to shower, a whole bunch of ants poured out because it wasn't used for so long. That first night out was just so miserable that I decided, okay, whatever, I'm going to knock on doors tomorrow. And from that day on, every single night that I knocked on the door, somebody said yes and invited me in.
So nobody ever said no, try some other neighbor?
Oh, most of people say no. One in five say yes.
Sometimes Zelong thought about turning back. The doubts passed, and the better moments arrived.
Those moments are when I connect with a stranger, when the next morning when I depart, we both have tears in our eyes. When I feel this connection with nature, feel this trust in the universe, those are just worth any of the pain, the discomforts.
Between Massachusetts and California, Zelong connected with lots of strangers. He remembers with special fondness some of the ones who most surprised him.
The Christian fundamentalists, the Republicans, the at that time would be the Romney or and now the Trump supporters. Essentially, for the majority of the trip in the middle of the country, I was staying every night with corn farmers, with people who are volunteering at the church. Those who I have thought are close-minded or xenophobic or all these labels, they were the most welcoming and warm and good-hearted people.
Would those people have been as welcoming, warm, and good-hearted to anyone asking for tent space and perhaps a cup of tea? Zelong wonders about that in a blog he wrote along the way.
Just imagine, if I were black, I would be a good target for some paranoid neighborhood watch. If I were Hispanic, people might wonder if I'm in the country legally. If I were Middle Eastern, I might look like a terrorist to some. If I were a white American, I wouldn't be as interesting as someone from China.
And he was on a bicycle. Maybe people figured what harm could be in him.
For all the magic of his crossing, for all the cosmic connections that were forged, there was little conventional drama. No fights, no violence, no steamy love scenes, just a young man pedaling a bicycle all day and talking quietly to people in the evening.
The people's home that I went into, they say, aren't you afraid? Have you met any bad people? For that entire 75 days, I have met exactly zero bad person, not even a harsh word or ill intention from anyone, only goodwill after goodwill. So it really gave me a lot of faith in not just the U.S., but also in humanity in general.
In general, his entire journey, I think, went like almost like a dream. Good luck with the weather, good luck with his bicycle. Everything seemed to work really well. His health was good. He didn't get injured, didn't get ill. Everything went pretty well until he reached the end.
When I was riding through the U.S., I didn't even bring a lock with me. I never locked my bike once. I leave it outside Walmart, at museums, outside little towns, and go away for half an hour, come back, the bike is still there. Nobody touched it. 3 weeks after arriving in San Francisco, the bike was stolen while locked as I went into a fruit stand to get some oranges just within 5 minutes.
Zelong called the police. He described the bike. One of the officers wrote down what he said. Zelong was not encouraged to think the white dragon horse would turn up.
The loss is greater than the bike. If, as he's always believed, the stolen bicycle he'd bought back in Shanghai was taken from him as some sort of cosmic retribution, what does it mean that he's now also lost the white dragon horse, the honestly acquired engine of his transformation and his great understanding and appreciation of so much of life, knowledge, and America? Is this really, he thinks, how the cosmic tale of the white dragon horse was supposed to end? And if so, what to make of it? What is the lesson?
The lesson took about 48 hours to reveal itself, and then it was a beaut. It turned out that a young woman who worked for a company that made bicycle accessories and, hence, knew something about bikes, saw the man who stole the white dragon horse with the steed. She thought, he doesn't look as if he belongs on it.
The guy was dressed raggedly. He was not a cyclist. He was running against traffic, and the bike was way too big for him. And this woman, Vanessa, decided, well, that's weird. That bike is probably stolen, but what am I going to do about it? Something you see every day in San Francisco. But for some reason, she couldn't let this go. She couldn't just let the guy ride away. So she started following him, got closer to him, and the guy pulled up into a doorway of an apartment building. And Vanessa said that normally she would never think about doing anything like this. She never done it like it before, but something was telling her, well, I'm going to just talk to this man. Finally, she said, this isn't your bike, this is Paul's bike. The name Paul just jumped into her head, but that was enough to break the ice and the guy split. It was meant to be. The cosmos was telling her to get this bike back for this man.
Yeah, that's actually the core of the story, and I'm forever grateful for her, Vanessa was her name, for restoring my faith in humanity.
Who would ask for more than to have his or her faith in humanity restored? And then there's this question, who, having ridden across the United States, would ever want to get on a bicycle again?
So I worked in San Francisco for 2+ years, and one day had this calling that I should go on a journey to the east and ride my bike back to China, where I was from. So 9 months ago, I embarked on this journey to the east, a pilgrimage more or less around the world once by bicycle, in service of the ecological and spiritual awakening of our time.
And how's that trip going?
Very well. Well, in the sense that a pilgrimage gives you not what I think I want, but exactly what I need, including all the hardship and the turmoils inside and outside.
So, the lesson. Perhaps there is no end point to the quest for enlightenment. Maybe once one begins accumulating faith in humanity, mysteriously, the vessel never overflows. Zelong rides on. John Brandt's story from Bicycling is called Zelong Wang and the Cosmic Tale of the White Dragon Horse and the Karmic Moonbeams of Destiny that Restored All Faith in Humanity. It's one of 27 worthy entries in 2016's Best American Sports Writing. Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Martin Kessler. We had help this week from Alex Schroeder. Our technical director is Marquise Neal. Our intern is Jeremy Relosa. And our senior producer is Gary Wallach. Our final word this week comes from stand-up comedian Michelle Tomko.
I think the Browns team motto should be giving the Pittsburgh Steelers confidence since 1964. Like, if Cleveland sports teams were the godfather, the Browns are Fredo.
So that would make the Bengals Michael or Sonny Corleone. I'm Bill Littlefield. We return next week with more sports, NPR style, on Only a Game. Thank you very much for listening.